From the land to Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for the 28th day of March 2025. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. No update to the commodity markets this afternoon for this program as Mike Zuzulo is out of the office. However, we will talk about the weather forecast with Eric Snodgrass as usual. He's with Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agrible. And then we'll take up wetlands, constructed wetlands in particular, and an interesting conversation with Jill Castell. She's with the Wetlands Initiative and Marshall County farmer Rex Newton. You'll find that of interest as well. I'm really positive it's a good conversation you'll want to listen to. And then in the second half hour of the day, if you can stay with us on our home station, you'll hear all of Commodity Week. If not, it's up online right now on demand at willag.org with panelists including Dave Chatterton, Kurt Kimmel, and Greg Johnson, all on this Friday afternoon edition of the Agricultural Programming that comes to you from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world, online, on demand at willag.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
We're now joined by Eric Snodgrass. He's at Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agrible. Thanks for being with us on a Friday. Looks like today's going to be a good day to get out and do some work in the yard, I suppose.
Yeah, but it's like one of those things where you know it's setting us up for something, right? Like when we get this mild at the end of March, it's always a precursor to something else crazy happening. And we do have to be on the lookout later this weekend for the risk of severe weather, especially as we get into the day on Sunday. So yeah, beautiful. Get out, enjoy it, do whatever you can outside, but just keep a very close eye on the radar going into the later part of the weekend. We do have an enhanced risk. That's a 3 out of 5 on the Storm Prediction Center's scale for very strong thunderstorms coming through this weekend. So yeah, temperatures, I mean, we may hit in western Iowa, Nebraska, parts of South Dakota, may get 90 today. That's just nuts, Todd.
Wow. So is that a trend for April? Does it set up weather that is severe in April, which sometimes happens? What are you expecting?
Yeah, I am expecting the severe, especially through the first full week of April and probably into the second. And April's an active month for us anyway. But if you asked me what I thought the temperatures are going to do this April, I'm just going to confess, I have no idea. Todd, I've spent a week trying to figure out if April is going to be warm, if it's going to be cold, if we got a frost risk coming in the middle of the end of the month, which is not uncommon, but you got a lot of guys that have seen some warm conditions in March wanting to get out there and not just scratch the dirt, but get some stuff going. And they're looking at me going, hey, are we going to get another cold spell? And I'm like, maybe. I hate it, Todd, but I do not know. I don't know what's going to happen in April. So full confession, I feel quite limited in my ability to see into the future right now.
Well, what happens this week? I know you've given us a preview of some weather that's severe, but really, what are you looking at?
Yeah, so here's the big news. Okay, so we do expect very heavy rains from eastern Texas all the way through the Ohio Valley. All that area we call the Mid-South, right? That whole region will likely be experiencing 3 and in some places up to 8 inches of liquid. Now, to the north of that, coming out of the Colorado Rockies into South Dakota, through Minnesota, northern Wisconsin, the next 3 systems I have lined up may put down a stripe in there between 7 and 20 inches of snow. Now, I spent all day yesterday and the day before that in Minnesota telling a bunch of Minnesota growers, you got a bunch of snow coming. And I'll be honest with you, no one was upset because they know they get to keep that moisture. Now, here's the real kicker. April 4th, 5th, and 6th, there's a system that's trying to come out to hammer the southern plains. That's where all that dust has been coming from, Todd. So if we hit that area with this heavy rainfall, that could be a major dent put in the new drought monitor, which just told us yesterday that we have 45% of the lower 48 in D1 to D4 drought. A year ago, we were at 20%, so we're more than double. So this is why this is so critical. But I can see the rain. I just have no idea what's going to happen with these temperatures beyond the next 2 weeks.
Okay, so no idea on the temperatures, but congratulations. You told us that you thought April, the spring, would be wet, maybe all the way through May. I won't ask you about that, but we do recall that you also told us that it's probably, maybe, possibly going to be dry in the summertime. Have things changed?
Yeah, well, you just rattled off the 3 most common vocabulary words of any meteorologist, probably, maybe, you know. But the reality is, Todd, the CPC last week released a forecast for summer, which puts the driest air right over Iowa. And that's too darn close to home for us. Now, it's echoing what other some other long-range models are doing as well. The European is not as aggressively dry as these other models. But man, if that happens and we hit the Black Sea with risk of dryness in summer, boy, this could be a very, very interesting marketing story. But listen, I told everybody last week, I'm showing you these things and telling you these things. Don't change anything today based upon it, right? These are all so speculative. And I just confessed, I can't even tell you what middle to late April temperatures are going to do. So take it all with a grain of salt, maybe the size of Champaign County, and let's just go on forward from there.
Well, are you better with South America? Do we have a good chance down there?
I actually do feel like I nailed one thing in South America, and that was the northeastern Brazilian drought. They had about 45 days of very limited rainfall. It rained last week, and I said, watch this area because I think it's going to go over dry again in April. And today's model runs took it back over dry. Now, it's 10 to 15% of the Safrinha crop. But any dent we can make in the Safrinha crop is good for U.S. farmers, right? So let's watch that carefully as well as La Nina fades and spring transitions, and I sit here in my office trying to figure out what the atmosphere is going to do next.
Okay, anything else before I let you go?
That's it.
All right, thanks much. That's Eric Snodgrass. He is with Nutrien Ag Solutions in Daggerville. Have a safe weekend, Eric.
Yeah, you too. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. Up next, some advice. Aaron Hager, weed scientist at the University of Illinois, wants to make sure that farmers understand about Enlist soybeans and 2,4-D.
One of the things that we really want to emphasize this year around 2,4-D is its use in soybean varieties that are resistant to it, and those would be the Enlist soybean system. There are only two available labeled post-emergence products containing 2,4-D that can be applied in crop in Enlist soybeans. Those would contain the choline salt formulation of 2,4-D, in particular either Enlist 1, which is 2,4-D choline by itself, or Enlist Duo, which is a premix of 2,4-D choline and glyphosate. There are no other salt formulations that can be used in crop, and we certainly do not want to use ester formulations in crop. Esters tend to have higher potential for volatility than salt formulations. And again, if we're concerned about off-target movement, applying an ester formulation in crop when air temperatures are typically going to be, you know, relatively higher than what they are when we use an ester in a burndown scenario, that is really something we discourage people from doing because it increases the likelihood of seeing damage to non-target vegetation across our landscape.
Aaron Hager is a weed scientist at the University of Illinois. His audio comes to us courtesy of Cesar Delgado, farm broadcaster in Ottawa, Illinois. Up next, a conversation I had for the Illinois Nutrient Loss Reduction Podcast, which you can find on our website at willag.org under the podcast tab. I spoke with Rex Newton, a farmer from Marshall County, Illinois, about a constructed wetland that he has on a property which he rents, and then with Jill Castell of the Wetlands Initiative. I started with Jill just to outline exactly what she does for them, and how constructed wetlands work and the things that they can do for your properties.
Yes, I'm the Water Resources Program Director. I have a background in civil and environmental engineering, and I manage our Smart Wetlands program at the Wetlands Initiative. And the Wetlands Initiative is a non-for-profit located here in Illinois. We design, restore, and create wetlands. We do this work through innovation, collaboration, and using sound science to improve water quality, habitat for plants and wildlife, and our climate.
What's the difference between a constructed wetland and what the Wetlands Initiative does?
Yeah, the majority of the work that we do is what we call wetland restoration. And with a restored wetland, your goal is to restore the natural hydrology and native vegetation in a former wetland that was either drained, farmed, or otherwise modified, so it doesn't have its hydrology and its plant life anymore. And the purpose of this practice is really to restore wetland functions, habitat, and diversity to something similar to what was its original condition before being modified. A constructed wetland is an engineered ecosystem that can be built anywhere but on a former wetland. It is essentially an artificial wetland ecosystem designed to mimic a natural wetland's ability to clean water. In this case, the wetlands are sited to intercept a tile main and designed to provide the optimal conditions needed for the wetland processes to remove excess nutrient as much as possible. And in this case, our main goal is nitrate removal, since tile drainage is responsible for most of our agricultural nitrate load in our streams and lakes. But I would say, because we are using native vegetation and developing this shallow emergent marsh, they can also provide valuable wildlife, waterfowl, and pollinator habitat. And this constructed wetlands is what we do through our Smart Wetlands program.
When you're thinking about wetland restoration, how do you know if a wetland was there previously?
We can tell by the soils. Wetland soils have specific characteristics, and those characteristics stay even if the hydrology or the water levels have been modified, they've been drained off. Those soil characteristics remain, and that's one of the ways we identify a former wetland, is looking at the soils.
In the case of the wetland that you've been working with Farmer Rex Newton on, and we'll hear from him in just a bit, is that a restored or a constructed wetland?
That is a constructed wetland for cropland tile drainage treatment, which is the official conservation practice name. And so that was designed specifically to intercept a number of tiles. We put them two tiles. That means that we're coming through their property and joined them into one tile, and that goes directly into the wetland. The wetland processes occur, that water stays in there for a while. Wetlands are doing all the awesome things that they do, and then we have a structure at the end that controls the water levels, and then the water eventually then goes right back out into the creek it would have gone to, you know, directly if it wasn't intercepted by the wetland. And water leaving the wetland has a lot less nitrate than it did coming into the wetland.
Do you verify that through sampling or some other form?
Yes, we have monitored two other constructed wetlands. But yeah, we've done watering. They're actually quite easy to monitor because you can just monitor and take a water sample of what's coming into the wetland and what's leaving the wetland, and you'll see a difference in the concentration and the load. So we can estimate how much we're removing. Now, the wetland that will be monitoring will begin on that this year. So we'll have a better sense of how well that wetland is working. But in general, constructed wetlands, if they're designed correctly and sized correctly, we expect at least a 50% nitrate removal. Some of our wetlands remove up to 80, 90% of the nitrate coming in.
And how do they do that? Is it just captured by the plants? Does it stay put? Is it removed in some other form?
Yes, we are really relying on the microbes that are living in the sediment and on the plants within the wetlands. Plants do take up nutrients to grow, but those plants also die, so they can release some of those nutrients back into the water column. But the process that's really sustainable is the ones done by the microbes, which is converting that nitrate into a nitrogen gas. So the microbes will do there if there's nitrate, and they will breathe the nitrate in the absence of oxygen. So you want to have a little bit of an anaerobic layer in the wetland. And then the carbon from the plants and the sediment is what provides them their energy to do that work. So if you have carbon, you have nitrate, and you have microbes, they will keep on removing nitrate forever. It's a very sustainable process.
What considerations should farmers and landowners keep in mind when considering a wetland for their properties?
Well, we want to make sure we have somewhere where there's a tile main that we can intercept. I feel like somewhere between 30 to 200 acres of tile drainage is a good size for these. It doesn't take too much land out of production, because we want the wetland treatment area to be at least 1% of the drainage area captured, and then therefore the total project size is closer to 5%. So we like those odd corners or areas that may be slightly wet or hard to farm. Those are kind of the best areas to put it. But they also have to really consider that this is a we don't say permanent practice, but we are excavating. We are digging, you know, essentially a pond and not filling it up. We only have about at maximum two feet of water in these wetlands, because that's the ecosystem that removes the best, is best for removing nitrogen. So we have to, you know, and the other thing you have to consider that it's a capital cost. You know, this is not, of all the tile treatment practices, this is probably the most expensive one. However, it's also one of the most cost-effective practices given the amount of nitrate these wetlands can remove, and as well as their longevity with very low maintenance. The good thing is that we currently have farm bureau programs that can provide financial assistance to help offset some of those costs in installing a wetland. All wetlands play a very major role in reducing nutrients, even, you know, restored wetlands, constructed wetlands. Wetlands are often referred to as nature's kidneys, as they can clean, you know, purify water by removing the pollutants. And so restored or constructed wetlands can do this. Constructed wetlands, we are just designing it such that we're really trying to optimize that nutrient removal.
Jill Castell is with the Wetlands Initiative. She mentioned a farm that they've been working on putting in a constructed wetland that's operated by Rex Newton. I spoke with him as well. I started by asking Rex to tell me just a little bit about himself and his operation.
Oh boy. Well, I started farming in 75, so this is going to be my 50th year. In the early 80s, I started dabbling with no-till because the NRCS office had a planter that they were letting us use to demonstrate. So I did some strips and what have a yielded challenge, I guess you'd call it. And I'll be darned, the no-till was about a little over six bushel better. And I thought, well, that's not bad. So I've started growing there with a no-till, and the attachments back in that era weren't all the greatest. You know, no-till was kind of in the back burner. So I've grown that, and I've seen benefits from it. The one landlord is pretty conservation-minded, so he's the one that put the wetland in.
Why is it you wanted to put the wetland in?
I'd say it was both of us, but I left it up to the landlord to make the decision, because I had gone to a meeting that Jill spoke at, and I thought, well, this is interesting. So I approached the landlord and told him we ought to look into this, whether we do it or anything or not. So that's when Jill and Gene come out to our farm and visit with him, and he got interested in it, and that's come to happen. You know, we got one in there. It drained 60 acres of tile, and I think the wetland's 2.8 acres. But we also got pollinator plot and stuff like that around it too. So it was pretty easy sell, really, mainly because he's pretty conservation minded. And we've grown that. Now we're concentrating on nutrient management with cover crops, 6 years of cover crops. And strip till, I started doing some of that about 4 years ago. And Todd, we've never, in 1982 was the last year a mow board plowed, and it was a disaster. Because 83 ended up being a drought year, and that corn on corn mow board plowed me 56 bushel to the acre. And then across the road, I no-tilled corn on bean stubble, and it made 125 bushel the acre. So that was another selling point to change my operation.
From the farmer's perspective, after the fact, is there much management that has to be done with the wetland? Do you have to care for it very much?
Well, not so far. I mean, they got a person that comes in and checks on it and tries to manage the species of weeds that we don't want. Right now, we've got some cattails, and I'm sure that's from the seed bank. You know, when you dig down that deep, why, you're going to get some seeds from way back. So we're going to start sampling the water coming in and the sampling of the water going out. And that way I got some real stats that I can use on both sides. I got corn and soybeans, and I'd like to take some out of those tile lines to test. So I even got a comparison there. One side will be corn and one side will be beans. So then I'll have nitrogen on one side of the creek to test, and and then cover crop on the bean stuff or on the corn stalks growing the beans on the other side. So I'm kind of excited about seeing how that's going to prove to me whether I'm doing the right thing or not. I feel like the science is telling me I'm doing the right thing, so I feel comfortable there. But I think this would be more of a selling point, so to speak.
Yeah. So if you take tile line samples out of the cornfield, out of the wetland field, and then out of the soybean field, plus if you were able to convince them to pick up samples prior to your cornfield, yes, after the cornfield, but before the wetland, out of the creek, and then before and after the soybean field, you'll have a whole lot of data to show what really is happening across the board.
What's right
across the board on all three of your fields, and then what the total load is coming out, and what it looked like going
right
in too. Fantastic. That's really good stuff. I hope that's able to take place. Any advice for farmers and landowners who are considering adopting a wetland? I mean, you were there, I'm sure, as they were building it, trying to figure out where to place it, those sorts of things. What do you suggest?
Well, you got to be patient, for one thing, because it seemed like it took so long for the seeds to get started and stuff like that, your pollinators, plots, and then you have invasive weeds you got to control. As far as the soil and work that they did, that was fine. And then starting to see how it was going to really work was kind of fun to me, because I'd go down there and look and start seeing some different birds. And I don't know my bird names, species, but they were different. And then the monarchs showing up. It just kind of gives you a good sense that this has got to be good. And like I said, if I get some test results on the nitrates and stuff that it is removing, it'll be that much more rewarding, I'm hoping. So basically, it helps, Todd, when you got a landlord that's interested in saving the soil for the next generation.
Rex Newton is a conservation-minded farmer from Marshall County, Illinois, that has been working with his landowners to improve their properties. In this case, by deploying a constructed wetland. We also talked today with Jill Castell from the Wetlands Initiative. She was working with Rex and the property owner to put the constructed wetland into place. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world, online, on demand, anytime you'd like at willag.org. That's willag.org. If you can stay with us, you'll hear our Commodity Week program next. If not, it airs on many of these radio stations over the weekend, and it's already up on the website and in your favorite podcast applications. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.